Well, it's good to be here again, and I think yesterday's lecture on Pelagianism and the cultural mandate provides a good platform for today's topic, which is aesthetics. Now, if you're not familiar with that term, that is the branch of philosophy that deals with beauty and art and the nature of beauty and things like that. One of the reasons that we want to spend so much time on aesthetics is because our definition of art, music, and beauty has changed in recent years. Christian thinkers are asking unthinkable questions today. For example, they ask, what is art? Does a work of art have to be beautiful to be art? Does music have to be beautiful to be music? Is beauty something that is real, or is it just in the mind? And the answers that they give are anything but traditional. So we're going to look at two topics this afternoon. The first is beauty an indispensable ingredient of art and music? And the second is, if so, if it is an indispensable ingredient, then is beauty objective? Both the secularist and the Christian pluralist answer both questions in the negative. Beauty is not a defining component of art, and when art does contain the element of beauty, that beauty is relative. I'm going to address the question of whether beauty is an indispensable ingredient of art first. The traditional definition of art always involved the aesthetic element, that is, beauty used to be a non-negotiable component of art. There are some other non-negotiable components as well. They are creativity, craftsmanship, meaning, intelligence, originality, and sublimity. Art should also transport us beyond the purely rational to the transcendent. That is, it should provoke our imaginations. And to what degree a work of art achieved these goals determined its value as good or bad art, according to the traditional definition. Today, however, as I've said, beauty is not an essential component of art. It's a possible component, but it's also a disposable component. Now, this has been the position of non-Christian thinkers for quite some time, but now it's also become the position of many Christian thinkers in the music industry especially. And in response, I'm going to argue for the traditional definition of art in music. Those who dismiss beauty as essential reserve sublimity as the only essential component of art. To be sublime means to be great, inspiring, noble, and profound. The problem with this definition, though, not the definition of sublimity, but the sublimity being the only ingredient, is that many human achievements can qualify here. Famous military campaigns in sporting events could be sublime. For example, the Battle of Midway in the South Pacific during World War II couldn't have been more intriguing or profound had it been written by an accomplished novelist. The other example is the U.S. hockey team's win over the Soviet Union in the 1980 Winter Olympics, which is also sublime and inspiring. But neither of these events are considered art, even though there is the element of sublimity or greatness there. And the reason that they're not considered art is because they lack creativity. For example, the Japanese did not confer with the Americans to force the events at Midway to turn out the way they did. Neither did the Soviets and the Americans have a Congress in 1980 to decide who was going to win the hockey game. They worked independently, each with the purpose of winning, and not for creating some kind of a grand cliffhanger or the triumph of the underdog. So the element of creativity is definitely missing, and therefore sublimity alone cannot be an irreducible component of art. Creativity and craftsmanship must also be included. Others who dismiss beauty as an essential component reserve the very thing we've been talking about, creativity, as the only essential component of art. But again, creativity cannot be the only essential component, since one can be quite creative in fixing a meal or baking a cake. One can be creative in organizing a political campaign, but none of these things would be considered art, and I think you'll agree there. So then creativity alone cannot constitute art. Some would include several elements except beauty. They would include things like transcendence, creativity, craftsmanship, meaning, intelligence, originality, and sublimity, but not beauty. Let's see how that works out. What if we were to have several of these elements minus beauty? Would we still have art? If merely these things, again, I'll list them, transcendence, creativity, meaning, originality, sublimity, and intelligence, constituted art, famous epigrams would qualify as art. During the hijackings of September 11th, 2001, some passengers on the fourth plane flying over the state of Pennsylvania literally hijacked the hijackers and prevented the plane from becoming a flying bomb. The leader of that group was a man named Todd Beamer, and his command to the rest of the passengers to go on the offensive was two words: let's roll. Now, ever since then, let's roll has become a household term in America for going on the offensive. And everybody identifies that statement with Todd Beamer and recognizes its significance. Another example, a little bit closer to home for you. During the siege of Bastogne, during the Battle of the Bulge, the German commander demanded that Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe surrender his forces to the Germans. And McAuliffe's reply consisted of only one word: nuts. Some of you said it before I did, because it's become a classic, right? Now, both Beamer's last words and McAuliffe's words have the qualities of creativity, transcendence, meaning, originality, sublimity, and intelligence. But they are not beautiful. They are not art. A New Testament epistle is no more a work of art than a letter is today. Yet the epistles of Peter and Paul were creative, sublime, and intelligent. There is little, however, in them that can be considered art. Peter, for one, would not have considered himself an artist, but a fisherman. So then the epistles should be categorized as proclamation media rather than art. A prize-winning photo of starving children in Africa containing painful images may communicate to the soul. It may be sublime, creative, inventive, and even brilliant. But it is not art, because it is not beautiful. It is instead what we would call kerygma, or proclamation. It may be that a horrible subject matter could be portrayed in an artistically skillful and brilliant way, but that doesn't mean that it is art. I saw many examples of anti-war art at the Imperial War Museum, but it really wasn't art, it was proclamation. In fact, many things we consider art are really proclamation with artistic elements involved, and therefore they are not art. Pablo Picasso said, "Art is not to decorate apartments. Art is a weapon of revolution, and my art is revolution," unquote. Picasso was dismissing in this statement the essential aesthetic element, the beauty element from art, and was turning art into propaganda. But the two are not interchangeable. There are other things that have masqueraded as art because they contain some beauty. An elaborately decorated wedding cake may have many of the same features as a beautiful painting, but ultimately it is designed to be eaten. It is not art, though it has artistic elements in it. Beautiful cars, houses, ships, and other things like that are not works of art since they serve a utilitarian purpose. They are sometimes called artwork because they contain aesthetic elements in them, such as creativity and beauty, and perhaps even sublimity. But they are meant for more than just aesthetic purposes. They're meant for more than just to be looked at and to be appreciated for their looks. They're meant to be used. At least they were originally designed that way. And this tells us that we have to distinguish between things that are true art and things that are other than art but contain artistic elements. Author Gene Veith makes this point very well in the following statement. Although the decorative and the functional can have aesthetic meaning, some works are made just for their aesthetic meaning alone. These are called the fine arts. A quilt may be beautiful, but its purpose is to keep someone warm. A house may have a striking design and attractive decor, but it exists not merely to be attractive, but to provide shelter. A painting in a museum, on the other hand, exists in its own right with no other purpose than to be beautiful and to be meaningful. Unquote. Now that is, of course, he is assuming a traditional view of the arts there. So then, this raises the question, is there any human endeavor dedicated exclusively to the purpose of creating, recognizing, appreciating, and cultivating beauty? If there isn't, there should be. And if there should be, what else would it be other than art as it has been traditionally defined? Now let's turn from art to music. Without beauty, music becomes just accumulated sound. It ceases to be music at all. Whatever can be said of other types of art, beauty is a non-negotiable component of music. Even the most abysmal forms of music, to be music, have to have some beauty in them. It's usually found in the melody. And though that beauty may be minute, badly impaired, and overwhelmed and obscured by the obnoxious elements, it still has to have some of it to be music at all. Think of it this way. Anti-musical genres, we talked about punk as one of them, destroy music by destroying the aesthetic element in it. They get rid of the beauty. They attempt to create non-music by removing beauty and order from it. Now, I'm not going to have you thumbing through text today, but I do have some Bible texts that I'll read to you that are important. And the first one that I want to look at is Exodus 32, 17 through 18. And Joshua heard the sound of the people when they shouted and said to Moses, "There is a sound of war in the camp." But Moses replied, "This is not the sound of the vicious shouts of the victor, nor is it the sound of the cowering response of the defeated. It is instead the sound of singing that I hear." Unquote. Now, it's clear from this passage that Joshua failed to find two indispensable ingredients of music in the sound that he heard. And so he assumed that it was battle noise. Okay. The two things that he did not find were order and beauty. Moses, though, listening more carefully, detected some faint musical elements, and he corrected Joshua. But Joshua wasn't all that far from the truth to begin with. He reached that conclusion because he presupposed that order and beauty were irreducible elements of music, and he couldn't detect them, at least initially, in the noise that he heard from the mountain. Moving on, if we have effectively made the case that art must be beautiful, we still have another battle to fight. Because when it comes to contemporary aesthetic philosophy, the definition of beauty is also up for grabs. So what if music has beauty, they would say? What is beauty anyway? Is there true beauty, or is it only in the eye of the beholder? If it is only in the eye of the beholder, then how can you tell me that my style of music is aesthetically inferior to yours? Those are the kinds of questions that they bring up. And so we're going to look at two major categories of beauty that aesthetic philosophers recognize today: objective beauty and relative beauty. First is objective beauty. Like objective truth, which is true whether anyone acknowledges it or not, objective beauty transcends time, culture, and human opinion. For example, if the Swiss Alps are objectively beautiful, then they would be truly beautiful whether a million people acknowledged it or none. Unfortunately, those who believe in objective beauty are pejoratively labeled as Platonists. Give you a little bit of a basic philosophy lesson here. Plato believed that every visible object had its own perfect and invisible prototype or idea. And one of Plato's prototypes was beauty. This was the permanent property that belonged to all beautiful objects. So it is something that is there, even though you cannot adequately describe it. And this property remains the same whether or not anybody admires the object or not. You don't have to admire something beautiful for it to be beautiful. Now, that's basically a good definition of objective beauty. But the Greeks also exalted beauty to idolatrous levels. Listen to Plato. "There can be no fairer spectacle than that of a man who combines the possession of moral beauty in his soul with outward beauty of body, corresponding and harmonizing with the former, because the same great pattern enters into both." It's even more evident in the next philosopher, Isocrates. "Beauty is the first of all things in majesty, honor, and divineness. Nothing devoid of beauty is prized. The supremacy of beauty over all things can be seen in our own disposition toward it and toward them. Other things we merely seek to attain as we need them, but beautiful things inspire us with love." Well, what can you say about that? I would say, so what? Why should a doctrine that has any resemblance to pagan philosophers require an apology? Is there no such thing as common grace? Are unbelievers mistaken about everything? And finally, should the Greek worship of beauty cause us to appreciate it less? The Platonic concept of transcendent or objective beauty is not that far from the truth, I would argue, and is supported by the typology of the real and the shadow in the book of Hebrews. I'll read a couple of passages, 9:23 and 24. Listen carefully. "Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us." Chapter 10, verse 1, "For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very form of the things, can never, by the same sacrifices year by year, which they offer continually, make perfect those who draw near." If you didn't pick all that up, there is a distinction that is being made of the perfect in heaven and the copy of it on earth, which is less than perfect. Romans 3:23 is helpful here as well. "For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." Now, this indicates that there is a perfect standard, invisible but real, by which we are going to be measured. Therefore, the argument against objective beauty along the lines of Platonism is a meaningless ad hominem device that derogates the Bible as well as the advocates of objective beauty. To the contrary, belief in objective beauty requires belief in a personal God, because in an atheistic universe, there are no transcendent objective laws of any kind. There are no laws of ethics. There are no laws of aesthetics either. Nothing is actually beautiful or ugly. These things are only relative to the individual and the community. In an atheistic universe, one could claim that the smell of a rose is inferior to the fertilizer that helped it grow. Likewise, Two people could be gazing at a sunset on the Hawaiian Islands. One could comment that the scene is beautiful, majestic, and breathtaking, while the other could find it unappealing, ugly, or even repulsive, preferring rather the sight of a junkyard. As unthinkable as this sounds, a consistent atheist must admit that neither individual is right or wrong. And that's because there is no such thing as true beauty to begin with. There's only relative beauty or beauty in the eyes of beholder. Now, the Christian pluralist ends up in the same trouble and has to affirm the same type of absurdities. The pluralist can no more scorn someone who enjoys the melody of a jackhammer or an outboard motor than the atheist. Because whenever you plunge yourself into the abyss of relativism, you end up affirming the absurd. Now, pluralists will certainly contest what I've said and say that you're inventing impossible scenarios. But these are not impossibilities, because as we saw yesterday, the depravity of man permits this type of affection, even to that degree. But we can also document these types of things in movements that have taken place. We can see this in the aesthetics of John Cage and anti-art movements like the Futurists, the Dadaists, and their offspring, the Punks. Finally, the existence of objective beauty can be supported by the very nature of God. Theologians recognize beauty as one of the attributes of God. According to many, God's beauty is the sum of all desirable qualities. That is, God possesses all qualities that are truly desirable to man. Hugo of St. Victor said, "The world is like a book written by the finger of God, and its invisible beauty is an image, and its visible beauty is an image of invisible beauty." New Testament scholar from Westminster Seminary, Dan McCartney, puts it this way: "Indeed, beside God's beauty, all earthly beauty is but a pale reflection. Yet since God's beauty is one of his communicable attributes, his image bearers should reflect it." Now I'm going to shift our focus to the second type of beauty that aesthetic philosophers recognize, and that is relative beauty. But there are several varieties of relative beauty, and so we'll go through them, four of them. The first is called category beauty, and this means that the beauty of any work of art should be determined within the genre or classification to which it belongs. Therefore, in the case of music, classical arrangements should be compared with other classical arrangements, but not to rhythm and blues or jazz. That is category beauty. There are principles, in other words, within the classification or genre that determine whether a single expression of that genre is considered beautiful. But we should not compare across categories according to this theory. The second type of relative beauty is called utilitarian beauty. The determining factor here is whether or not an item is ideally designed and suited for its task. Under these conditions, even something as ordinary as a cement mixer can be considered beautiful. If the design of the cement mixer is ideally suited for its task, those in the industry who appreciate cement mixers and the fine points of them can say that this model is truly beautiful. Therefore, beauty is defined as suitability for the task, according to utilitarian beauty. The next is culturally conditioned beauty. Culturally conditioned beauty. A painting of an abandoned farmstead with a dilapidating barn, broken fence, rusting plow, and a cartwheel all surrendering to tall grasses and wildflowers is beautiful, even though it depicts decay, waste, and regress. Now, I should qualify that it is beautiful to an American culture, because it signifies that nature is reclaiming its losses to industry and civilization. And there's a large element of American society that desires to be closer to nature and conserve nature. It also connects us with our past and reminds us of the simplicity of rural living, which is beyond the reach of most city dwellers today. But that's American culture. To an agrarian culture in Africa, which battles nature every day and often loses, this painting may be ugly and counterproductive. So according to culturally conditioned beauty, our culture determines what is beautiful. And the last phase of this is sentimental beauty, sentimental beauty. Here, the determining factor for beauty is purely emotional or sentimental. Both men and women are often attracted to their mates who may, objectively speaking, lack attractiveness. All parents consider their newborn infants to be beautiful, even though objective beauty may be lacking. I realize that I'm getting myself into some trouble here, but I'm going to keep going. There are also juvenile attempts at beauty. For example, a child's first drawing or song. And the beautiful element there is the sentimentality. In every one of these cases, the determining factor is not something that is objectively good or beautiful, or I would say objectively beautiful, but sentimentality. So the pluralist concludes, we're done with that category, so the pluralist concludes that the existence of relative beauty supplants objective beauty altogether, so that beauty is entirely a relative judgment. Now let me respond to that conclusion. All the types of beauty that we just looked at, the four classifications, are in fact legitimate categories that we exercise every day. But their existence does not abrogate the existence of objective beauty. In other words, you can have both, in my opinion. Let's revisit these categories, but in reverse order. Let's begin with sentimental beauty. As you remember, sentimental beauty is based not on objective criteria, but on some relationship to the individual. But people easily recognize that sentimental judgments of beauty do not supplant objective claims of beauty. There is a good reason why your child's sailboat drawing hangs on your refrigerator and not in the National Gallery, because it is not good art. Digging myself in deeper and deeper here. If you think that's bad, will you hear this? For the same reason, most men who tell their wives that they are the most beautiful creature on earth never attempt to prove it by entering them in a beauty contest. Now, I'm really glad that my wife is not here to listen to any of that. Therefore, just because we choose to exercise sentimental beauty does not mean that we have abandoned the concept of objective beauty. Let's move on to the culturally conditioned element. Even though cultures might disagree on what beautiful is, there are still certain boundaries. Earlier, I described the elements of an abandoned farmstead, but I was very careful about what I included. I said that it had a dilapidating barn, a broken fence, a rusting plow, a cartwheel, tall grasses, and wildflowers. Now, suppose we added to the scene of decay a rusting pickup truck, old used tires, an old bathtub, the skeleton of a crow, and piles of rubbish. Even these additional elements are also things that you can expect to see at an abandoned farmstead, they don't quite add to the beauty of the scene. They take away from it. It all of a sudden becomes ugly. So then, even when it comes to decay, we have to be selective in order to achieve beauty. Both the African farmer and the nostalgic American would agree that beauty is lost when those other things are added. Now we move to utilitarian beauty. Remember, the excellence of design and suitability of the task was the criterion there. If you remember, I used the example of a cement mixer, and that it may be beautiful to a connoisseur of cement mixers because of its design. But that same connoisseur would not say that it is objectively beautiful. He is not saying that the cement mixer has the graceful lines of a Porsche, or the meticulous tolerances of a Mercedes, or the majesty of a Rolls-Royce. Only that it is beautiful as far as cement mixers go. Just like man-made products, natural artifacts also incorporate beauty with utility. Every feature of an animal serves some practical function for its survival. Therefore, we often make aesthetic statements about animals relative to their survival design. Because of this, we can call a crocodile, with its toothy smile and spike-armored body, magnificent and beautiful, because it is ideally suited, superbly suited for its task. But is it heresy to compare a crocodile to a swan or a peacock? Contrary to popular opinion, it is not. Both the swan and the peacock are more beautiful than the crocodile, and that beauty is not merely utilitarian. So then there is a beauty within categories, and there is a beauty that crosses categories. There is a reason why the Swiss Alps attract thousands of tourists every year, whereas a muddy watering hole in Texas attracts none. Human beings constantly make aesthetic comparisons across categories and species, and with good reason. It would be an absurd exercise in political correctness to insist that the Texas watering hole is just as beautiful as the Alps, but in a different kind of way, and therefore it deserves equal time on our walls, on our postcards, and on our calendars. Who would agree to that? Therefore, just because we believe in utilitarian beauty doesn't mean that we have abandoned the concept of objective beauty. Now we come to category beauty. Some pluralists claim that each created thing has its own type of beauty and should not be compared with other species, which have their own type of beauty. They often quote 1 Corinthians 15:40. There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is of one kind, and the glory of the earthly is of another. Therefore, the conclusion is you don't compare the beauty of an orchid to a cactus, or a collie to a bulldog. But you compare an orchid with another orchid, and a cactus with another cactus, and so on. You can apply this to music when it comes to different genres of music. Again, there are problems with this, because even if you remain within categories, you still have not escaped the need for a transcendent ideal to determine which orchid is more beautiful. And even when you're comparing bulldogs, there is still no criteria, are no criteria for determining which one is more beautiful. Is it the one with the gray patch over its eye or the brown patch? Is it the one that is black and tan in color or brindle in color? When it comes to human beings, this becomes even more difficult. One other point is that 1 Corinthians, the following verse after verse 40, that's verse 41, says that star differs from star in glory, affirming that there are differences in splendor even within categories. In other words, you haven't really solved anything by remaining in the category. You still need some objective, transcendent standard. Now, there are some scriptures that I think are very useful in guiding our thinking here. Let me go through these. The first is in Proverbs 31. You may ask what could be so useful about a poem on the habits of the ideal woman. This poem tells us that tells the young man to value virtue rather than outward beauty. Verse 30 says, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised." So then when Proverbs, when verse 30 says beauty is fleeting, I think that's the original sense there. It is depreciating the importance of beauty in choosing a mate. Now, here's where we get some aesthetic guidance from this passage. If Proverbs is discouraging the pursuit of a mate based on beauty alone, then it's also the case that not all young women, or men for that matter, are objectively beautiful. I know I'm getting myself in trouble. This statement also implies that the beauty of youth depreciates with age. There is a greater beauty and a lesser beauty. Now, unless there was some objective standard for beauty, this statement would be meaningless, since someone like Mick Jagger would be just as beautiful as Princess Diana in a relativist economy. Do you remember Mick Jagger? He's unforgettable, isn't he? Finally, we see here a demotion of beauty in importance and priority, which flies in the face of the Greek worship of beauty. So that's very important about this passage. I'll go on with James 1 and verse 11. For no sooner has the sun arisen with a burning heat than it withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beautiful appearance perishes. Like Proverbs 31:30, here the beauty of the flower is temporary and is less beautiful after experiencing the elements. James is saying that the flower changed aesthetically from a condition of beauty to non-beauty. Now, if beauty was relative, James could not make a statement like that because the withering flower would be just as beautiful as a fresh one, depending on the opinion of the individual. My next text is Lamentations 2:15. Is this the city of which they said, the perfection of beauty, the joy of all the earth? Now, there is a little bit of hyperbole here, but even granted that, how could Jerusalem be the joy of all the earth if conceptions of beauty differed so radically? The pluralist might respond to this by saying that these examples merely betray there are internal standards for beauty. The healthiest is the most beautiful, or the most pristine is the most beautiful. Let's look at them in order. Healthiest is the most beautiful. They would say that that the withered flower is not beautiful because it no longer is healthy and strong. Therefore, what is ravaged by sin lacks beauty. But that doesn't solve the problem because both the bulldogs that I mentioned earlier are healthy, though they're differently colored. That will not solve your need for a transcendent ideal. The second is the most pristine is the best. Beauty is equated with freshness, pristineness, newness. But a newly hatched robin has no feathers and bulging eyes, and it looks frightening in comparison to the adult, so it doesn't work with that. And if anybody is willing to admit it, even newborn human beings can be improved upon aesthetically. Now, to go from a comparison of orchids and cacti to Bach and Bono is quite a leap. So we're moving on to music here, and briefly at that. The pleasure we receive from music is not related to recognizing any suitability of design for survival. The aesthetic element in music is not a byproduct of its design for some other purpose. It is the purpose. Unlike nature, musical genres involve human depravity, creativity, and sometimes willful discreativity. So then, forms of relative beauty do not replace the existence of objective beauty, and neither should the worship of beauty by some cultures, such as the Greeks, force us to abandon the importance of beauty in art and music. I'm going to conclude with an anecdote, and that is my example of how to refute an aesthetic relativist, and that is to spend some time with him. Because if you spend enough time with them, you will realize that, or they will realize that they're being caught in affirming objective beauty. Some years ago, a blogger wrote a very indignant response to my book. And he was a pluralist, and still is, and aesthetic relativist. Here's what he said about my book. John's major contention is that there are, in fact, universal standards of beauty, timeless, transcendent aesthetic principles. He expresses his agreement with Platonic thought in this matter, unquote. Now, all this sounds, you know, all well and good until you spend time with this individual. Now, I didn't spend time with him since he was a blogger, but I just kept reading his criticisms, and here's what I found. Another quote from him. John's real problem is that he is a researcher, not a musician or a creative individual. He is one of those guys that could thoroughly document the science involved with every rock, tree, stream in the Yosemite Valley and yet miss the wonder of it, the beauty of it, unquote. Again, he is saying that, I'll read it again. He could thoroughly document the science involved with every rock, tree in the Yosemite Valley and yet miss the wonder of it, the beauty of it. Now, in case you're not aware, the Yosemite Valley is a very scenic and breathtaking place in Northern California. It has large cliffs, waterfalls, lakes, sequoia trees, and it is utterly beautiful. But that brings up the question, how can an aesthetic relativist like this judge someone for missing the beauty of the Yosemite Valley? What if I saw no beauty in it or found it repulsive? Why is it beautiful? What are the objective universal standards of beauty that I might know that it is beautiful rather than plain or ugly? Now, there are reasons why he chose the Yosemite Valley rather than a flat, plowed cornfield in Iowa. He felt that Yosemite was undeniably beautiful and his readers would automatically recognize it. And he's right. Yosemite is genuinely beautiful, not relatively beautiful, and it is beautiful whether I or anybody else acknowledges it or not. And why? Because there is such a thing as objective beauty. Therefore, I commend you to pursue beauty in your expressions of music and art. Thank you for your attention.